Dinosaurs in the Bible. You know, when I speak places, this is one of the most frequent questions I get, is about dinosaurs and how do they fit with the Bible. And this is kind of a basic presentation, but we'll talk about several different questions that people have. One is, did dinosaurs really exist? I'm amazed how often Christians will ask me, were they really alive? Were they really here at some point? Or was that something in the fossil record that was just put there by God? And if they did exist, what were they like? What did dinosaurs look like? Maybe how did they act? Did they live at the same time? Anybody been asked that question or thought about that question? Did people and dinosaurs ever live together? That's a huge one people want to know, and is there any evidence of that? Well, if they did, what does the Bible say, if anything, about dinosaurs? Does it mention dinosaurs? And here's something more recent. How many of you have heard of recent discoveries in the news about red blood cells, soft tissue being found in dinosaur bones? Anybody heard about this? Talk a little bit about that at the end of the presentation. But also then, what does secular science, what does the world tell us about dinosaurs? What are they saying about dinosaurs? And let's compare that then to what the Bible may say about dinosaurs. Well, dinosaur fossils were discovered. They did exist. I believe that they lived, and we'll talk much more about this morning. But in the 1820s, 1822, in England, it was a discovery of some fossils, kind of a rediscovery of dinosaurs. And Sir Richard Owen coined the term then dinosaur in 1841. So that's a relatively recent word. And the word itself means, as many of you probably know, terrible lizard. Terrible lizards, great lizards. Some of these were very large, the first ones they found. And that's a pretty good description of some of these. And the ones we tend to focus on are the real big dinosaurs, especially the meat-eating dinosaurs. People are enthralled by those for some reason. But, you know, the world is using them to good effect. The world is using dinosaurs to fish for the hearts and souls of young people, I believe. They're using them. And if you look at the secular media, what the world is teaching, in the year 2000, there was a movie out by Walt Disney, Dinosaur. And if you watch the themes here, they seem innocent and harmful, maybe, unless you really look at the underlying theology, in a sense, of what they're teaching us. Jurassic Park, of course, those movies really captured people's imagination. Some of the best-selling movies of all time. T-Rex, seems like it's everybody's, especially young boys, but everybody's favorite dinosaur seems to be T-Rex. They love T-Rex. And this is one model they have, and notice the bright colors there. This is a model in London at a museum. We don't know for sure what they look like exactly, but probably they did have some interesting colors because the creator, I believe, is very creative. But you go into museums. The world is teaching us a story. They're teaching us a worldview in our museums. And on television, the Discovery Channel has Walking with Dinosaurs, Walking with Cavemen, these things. I always call the Discovery Channel the sci-fi channel. It's great if you like science fiction. And most of it is fiction. If you really watch it, how much of it is factual and how much is their interpretation of the facts? Watch that carefully. They'll try to give you a few facts, but they base it on almost nothing and come up with some really interesting stories. And then you see stories in all kinds of magazines, very popular ones. National Geographic and Nature and Time and Newsweek, all these different magazines will feature something about these long ages in our past, and they're trying to tell a story. And it's not just recently. Back in 1953, the cover of Life magazine for September 7th said, "The world we live in, part 5, 2 billion years of evolution," and on the cover they used dinosaurs to represent that. This thinking has been around, of course, a long time. Well, recently, I teach geography, and I love to get out and take photos. In fact, I was on sabbatical this year taking photos from the college where I teach down in Oregon, and went with a group similar to the Creation Association of Puget Sound. Some of you attend here in this area. The Design Science Association down in Portland has taken some field trips, and one we took recently was down to the John Day fossil beds, and part of it was to the National Monument, part was to some private land and some public lands. We did some fossil digging on some private land. And we went also to this brand new, almost brand new museum. It opened August of last year. At the time we went there, it was about 10 months old, and I thought, well, this would be interesting to go to this paleontology center near the Sheep Rock Unit, or at the Sheep Rock Unit, take a look and see in this brand new museum what kind of displays they had. And I was really curious to see if they had modified anything or specifically tried to address the creation evolution issue more directly. And I wasn't disappointed. And by the way, this is an $8 million facility built with your tax dollars to promote evolution. And it's very effective. They have an interesting lab in there where they work on extracting the fossils from the rock matrix, and you can see some of the work sometimes when they're working in there. Very interesting. A lot of interesting displays, but I found some particularly intriguing. This one, they had some little glass cases, and it says, radiometric dating. How old is that fossil? And that's a good question. How old are they? How do they determine the age of a fossil when they find it? Well, notice on this, it says right underneath, scientists use radiometric dating to determine the age of the rocks surrounding a fossil. They use radiometric dating to figure out how old the rock is. Well, you might phrase it this way. How old is the fossil? To figure that out, you need to know how old is the rock. Okay. Well, that sounds reasonable, doesn't it? Then I went over to the next display case. I was actually shocked because I thought there's no way they would put this in there. But people don't think critically and they don't catch these things. So I took a picture of this one, biostratigraphy, using fossils to tell time. Okay, that's just a fancy word for looking at the different layers of fossils and using those as an index for time. Well, it says here, if you look at the fine print, biostratigraphy is a method used by paleontologists to determine the age of rock layers by the presence of certain types of plant and animal fossils. This process is based on the evolution of life forms. Notice their assumption, their presupposition, their way of thinking. That's what they're building it on, is assuming evolution in the first place. Over millions of years, rocks found in different parts of the world that contain the same type of fossil are considered by scientists to be the same age. By studying the fossil record over long spans of time, they've established a fossil clock for different types of ancient organisms. With that knowledge, they can work in this area to date rock layers, and notice what they say, solely on the presence of specific types of fossils. And I was confused. I thought, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. They're saying, how old is the rock? Well, look at what types of fossils are in it. Now, they just told me they use radiometric dating to determine the age of rocks, and that's how you figure out the age of a fossil. But see, people don't catch this. And this was side by side in two display cases in a museum. And they just told me two conflicting stories. How old is the fossil? How old is the rock? How old is the rock? What types of fossils are in it? That's called circular reasoning. And it's used quite often. We have to be careful, too, that we don't use it sometimes. But they're using the rocks to date the fossils, the radiometric dating methods. But then they turn around and say, well, we use the fossils to date the rocks. Really, what they're doing is assuming something to begin with. They start with an assumption that evolution has occurred. That's their presupposition. They presuppose it to be true. That's their bias or faith, belief, whatever you want to call it, their worldview. And that shapes their thinking. That's a very important point I always try to drive home when I talk to people, is understand the foundational assumptions that are being made. But this is a very interesting museum, and a lot of museums can be very educational. In fact, most of them could easily become creation museums. It would take some work, but the displays themselves, for the most part, could be left intact. And they have some very interesting ones there, put a lot of time and effort into these. And when you look at that, for the most part, with some exceptions, sometimes they have some things in there that maybe shouldn't be there that they have pieced together. But for the most part, you're seeing the facts. Now, in that area, they actually don't find dinosaur fossils, or haven't, but they have found a lot of mammal fossils. But you're looking at the evidence in the case. Then you look elsewhere in the museum, and you look at the writing, and all of that is their interpretation based on a naturalistic worldview, based on the assumption that evolution has occurred. So you always have to separate the facts from the interpretation of the facts. Naturalism And this was defined, if you were here, it's either last night or the night before, I guess 2 nights ago. But naturalism is basically a belief that the natural world is the whole of reality and there's no supernatural or spiritual creation, value, control, or significance. Basically saying scientific laws can explain all phenomena. It's ruling out, excluding by definition, the supernatural. And some people even use it synonymously with materialism, which is a similar philosophy. Well, here's another example in that area. Down near the town of Dayville, very little town, it's also close to Mount Vernon, Oregon, which is much, much smaller than the one here. The John Day River cuts through a formation. Many lava flows, very interesting. This is called Picture Gorge. And there are some rock writings in there as well. A lot of interesting features there to study. But as it cuts through there, it forms this interesting geological feature, and right across the road from where I took this photo, I walked across to a little sign the State Highway Department had put up, and here's what it said. Picture Gorge, the sharp, steep walls of Picture Gorge suggest a sudden cataclysm and not the slow, relentless forces that actually shaped it. How could it get any more plain than that, right? You see it. I was amazed. I imagine at some point somebody will point that out and complain and they'll change the wording because that's giving away the farm, basically giving away everything. Well, that was called in a recently published road guide to the John Day area of Central Oregon as Views from a Creationist Perspective. And I was on a field trip with two of the authors of that book and they pointed out that is blind adherence to uniformitarianism. The idea that slow, gradual changes over time have always occurred at these slow rates, uniform rates in these processes, and that's what shaped this. So it's like saying that, I think it was Dawkins who said, we have to keep in mind that what we're seeing wasn't designed. Even though it appears to be designed, it really wasn't. Same thing here. Even though it looks like it was formed cataclysmically, catastrophically, quickly, it wasn't. We know better. In spite of the evidence. Of course, we have to remember, facts don't speak for themselves. When I walked around there in the museum, not one of the skulls ever spoke to me. The facts don't speak. They have to be interpreted according to a worldview, a philosophical framework, a way of thinking. You've probably heard this expression. I wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't seen it. You know, that seeing is believing. I think quite often it's the other way around. We need to cross that out and rephrase it. I wouldn't have seen it if I hadn't believed it. I wouldn't have seen it if I hadn't believed it. Believing something is seeing. Now, that happens a lot more often than we think. But you believe something, then you see it. Let me give you an example of that. This is kind of a silly example, but it brings the point across. Not everyone gets this because sometimes people are thinking differently. It depends on your background, where you're from. A Texas rancher, and of course we know everything's big in Texas, a Texas rancher was bragging to a New Yorker, someone from the city, about how huge his ranch was. And so he said, I can drive all day and still only get halfway across my ranch. And the New Yorker just nodded sympathetically, said, yeah, I once had a car like that. Now, obviously they were thinking two different ways. And they reach different conclusions. So different assumptions, different starting assumptions lead to different conclusions. So when we look at dinosaurs, it's no different. Or when we look at geology, it's no different. Depending on what you believe to start with, you will see different things. I've had many people in my own church, in fact, I've had people come up to me, a woman who has been involved in anthropology her whole life and is now in her 70s. She came up and she said, but why does the world look so old? And I said, it's because you think it is, and you've thought that way so long, it's very difficult to change your thinking. I used to think that way, by the way. I was a diehard evolutionist when I started college and majored in physics and geology until I heard a speaker. Dr. Don Chittick actually came to my college. Some of you may have heard of him. He spoke here 2 years ago. And my thinking was changed. And so my starting assumptions were totally changed, but I was only about 19 years old. It was relatively easy for me to change my thinking. Someone who's ingrained in that, it takes a while. But if we look at it this way, in fact, I learned this from Dr. Chittick years ago, 20 years ago. You start out with one assumption, you look at the data, you'll come up with one conclusion. Someone else looks at it with a different assumption, different worldview. Same evidence, same data, entirely different conclusion, consistent with their assumptions. And it's because they have different starting points in their thinking that they reach such different conclusions. Here's an example, too, of people getting the whole problem wrong. They don't even understand what the issue really is. About a year and a half ago in National Geographic, the cover said, I was really anxious to see the answer, although I knew it before I turned there. It said, was Darwin wrong? I didn't expect to turn in there and say, yes, he was, and our whole philosophy has changed. They're one of the most pro-evolution organizations and magazines there is, which I hate to admit because I'm a geographer by profession. But when you turn inside the magazine, it said, of course, was Darwin wrong? No, emphatically. The evidence for evolution is overwhelming. Well, when I read through it as a creationist, I was very underwhelmed, and I was hoping for more evidence, something maybe that would really be something to refute. It was amazing at the lack of evidence, in my opinion. Of course, I looked at it very differently. But they missed the point. That's not the point. It's not the evidence. The creation-evolution battle, everybody has the same evidence to look at. We have the same facts. We have the same rocks, the same fossils, same dinosaur fossils. We have all the same evidence at our disposal. We can go into the same museums, go out to the same geologic features, and we see exactly the same things. The difference is how we interpret the evidence. It's how you interpret it based on your worldview. Well, let's take a look here and see, what does the Bible say? I always, as a Christian, base my thinking on the Bible. I think it's right to start our thinking there, use that to shape our interpretation of what we find. So, are dinosaurs mentioned in the Bible? Now, I know probably some of you, if you have studied this at all, you know some places where Bibles, or where in the Bible, they mention dinosaurs. And I want to look at some of those, but probably one you haven't looked at quite as much. But we have to realize, first of all, the word dinosaur doesn't appear in the Bible. Nowhere in the Bible. And there's reasons for that, very good reasons. The King James Version was translated in 1611, long before the word dinosaur was even invented. So the basic English translation that's still very commonly used hasn't been around very long. The word hasn't been around very long, and so it wasn't in that. 1841, the word was invented, 230 years before the King James Version, and other versions since then have stuck with a lot of the language of the King James, and I think because of the more humanistic thinking and evolutionary thinking that has just become so ingrained and very difficult to escape, that translators haven't wanted to put the word dinosaur in there, and they use other words. But they do use the word dragon in Scripture. You see that many times, actually several dozen times in the Old Testament, as well as a couple other words that we'll look at, but the Hebrew word tannin appears several times. Actually, this word appears in Genesis 1:21, is the first usage, and there it's translated great whales in the King James, when God created the great whales. Those were probably what were called dragons elsewhere, same Hebrew word, great sea monsters perhaps is what it was referring to. But we do see that word. Here are a couple examples. Isaiah 43:20. The beast of the field shall honor me, the dragons and the owls. Now, owls are real creatures. Dragons, I believe, were real. People think, oh, those were just mythical. There are all these stories about them. Well, there are a lot of stories about them. And there are enough that you start to wonder, maybe there was something to this. Jeremiah 14:6 says, the wild asses did stand in the high places, real animal. They snuffed up the wind like dragons. Now, there's comparing them to dragons. Why would you use a comparison of a real animal comparing it to a mythical animal to make a point? That wouldn't make sense. And there are many other places. But you also see in cultures throughout the world where they have stories about dragons. This is actually in Canada, but it's a Chinese dragon. And in China, in the Orient, you see this. Even on the flag of the flag of Wales, they have a dragon. A lot of the stories of dragons, there's an excellent book by Bill Cooper, After the Flood, that talks in one of the chapters at length about some of the dragon encounters in England and throughout parts of Europe. And some of those were as recent as about 300 years ago. And in fact, there are many detailed descriptions, scientific descriptions and cataloging of dragons in Europe in the Middle Ages. Why would they do that if they weren't real creatures? And all the descriptions seem to fit what we would call dinosaurs. In fact, in the World Book Encyclopedia, it even says that the dragons of legend are strangely like actual creatures that have lived in the past. They're much like the great reptiles or dinosaurs that inhabited the earth long before man was supposed to have appeared on earth. Dragons were generally evil and destructive, and every country had them in its mythology. Again, it's kind of like the flood legends. Why would you have that everywhere if they didn't exist? So I believe that the dragons were descriptions of what would we, today we would call dinosaurs. And, you know, I love to look at the beauty of what God has created. Even in a fallen world, this world is beautiful. We've had some time here to explore a little bit, and it's always, whenever I go anywhere, I'm just amazed at what God has created, the wonders of His creation. And we see in the book of Job, chapters 38 through 41, it's interesting to me that at the end of the book of Job, God never really answers Job's questions. What He does is pose a series of rhetorical questions to Job. I believe it's 77 questions. And they're designed to show Job and reveal to us God's incredible majesty and power. And He does that largely by emphasizing the things or these incredible creatures that He has made. And that, I believe, includes the dinosaurs. Job 38:4, he starts off saying, "Job, where were you?" And you've probably heard that question. "Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding." Now, you don't answer God when He asks you a question like that. You just remain silent, let Him do the talking. And you know, that's a good question sometimes to ask, though. None of us were there. Who are we to tell God what He has done? But then in Job chapter 40, you move ahead. This is a pretty familiar animal to many people. Behemoth. Anyone know what the Hebrew word was that was translated behemoth? Behemoth. It's actually, I believe it was behemoth. But it's the same word. It was a transliteration, actually. The translators weren't sure what to do with it, and so they just took the Hebrew word and put it into English. And it says here in Job 40, "Behold now, behemoth." God is speaking again to Job. "Behold now, behemoth, which I made with thee. He eateth grass as an ox. Lo now, his strength is in his loins, his force is in the navel of his belly. He moveth his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his stones are wrapped together. His bones are as strong pieces of brass. His bones are like bars of iron. He is the chief of the ways of God. He that made him can make his sword to approach unto him." God could control this huge animal. We couldn't, obviously. But then if you look in the margins of Bibles, they'll usually say something like this, possibly an elephant or a hippopotamus. And I looked, and sure enough, there it was, hippopotamus, in at least one of my Bibles, in the notes. Well, there's a verse there, verse 17, right in the middle, that especially gives us a unique characteristic that you don't find in any modern animal. "He moveth his tail like a cedar." And cedars, and we have a lot here in the Northwest, are large trees. The cedars of Lebanon were large trees, large trunks, very stout, just like the tail of an elephant. Right? That's more of a fly swatter. In fact, it is a fly swatter. Big animal, little itty-bitty tail. Not a tail like a cedar. In fact, if you look at a tail like a cedar, that doesn't fit, does it? That doesn't look like any elephant I've ever seen at the zoo. And if you look at a hippo, that's even wimpier. That's not a tail like a cedar. In fact, a hippo doesn't seem to fit at all to me. If you look at a tail like a cedar, there's a real large tail, a stout tail. That doesn't work. Hippo doesn't work. That, to me, works. That makes sense. Now, we don't know precisely what kind of animal it was, but probably one of the large sauropod dinosaurs. Could have been Diplodocus, Apatosaurus, Brachiosaurus. We don't know. In fact, we're finding more. They're cataloging. And it could have been any number of those, but it fits. Well, then in Job 41, it talks about another creature. That was the greatest land animal, apparently. And this is the greatest that was in the water, perhaps a large reptile or amphibian. Leviathan in Job 41, again, just transliterated. "Canst thou draw out Leviathan with a hook or his tongue with a cord? Out of his mouth go burning lamps, and sparks of fire leap out. Out of his nostrils goeth smoke as out of a seething pot or cauldron. His breath kindleth coals, and a flame goes out of his mouth. He maketh the deep to boil like a pot. He maketh the sea like a pot of ointment. And many Bibles will say that may have been a crocodile. Now, if you look at the description again, first of all, really none of that fits. I'll just pick out a verse here. 21 says, his breath kindleth coals, and a flame goeth out of his mouth. I've never seen a crocodile in the zoo that was a fire-breathing crocodile. And people say, well, there couldn't have been a fire-breathing animal. That sounds ridiculous. Of course, we don't know. When we get a fossil, none of them breathe fire. We don't know what it might have been. So we can't tell for sure. But it's obviously describing something, and we do have a lot of stories, accounts of dragons that could breathe fire in some sense. That matches with what the Bible says. Just because we don't understand it doesn't mean it didn't happen. We've found incredible things about creatures. I don't have any doubt that somehow they could do this. So someone's drawn what may have been Leviathan. Could have been a Kronosaur or a Plesiosaur. We don't know for sure. A Kronosaur fits a little bit better because it does seem to have some description that might be more crocodilian. But in the Psalms, in chapter 74, there's mention. In fact, Leviathan is mentioned several times. Behemoth only once. Leviathan, I believe, five places in Scripture. But here it's mentioned, thou didst divide the sea by thy strength. Thou breakest the heads of the dragons in the waters. Thou breakest the heads of Leviathan in pieces. Mentioned there in several other locations in the Old Testament. Well, in the book of Romans, chapter 1, verse 20, we're told the invisible things of God, of Him from the creation of the world, are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so they are without excuse. You know, people without excuse, if they deny there's a creator, there is evidence in God's creation that just shout that there must be a designer, a creator. And you'll hear more of that today in the conference. As I said, I love to go out and take photos of God's creation. This is down at the John Day Fossil Beds. And to me, I look at that, I'm always in awe at what the Creator has created, even after the judgment on sin, the worldwide flood described in Genesis 6 through 9. Even after all that, we still live in a beautiful world, and it's not paradise. But the painted hills are just amazing, the flowers and the geology. Genesis 1, he said, God created every winged fowl after his kind, and God saw that it was good. The flowers in bloom, just the subtleties sometimes in God's creation are amazing. Here in the Northwest, we have such beauty and diversity, and you just go across the Cascades and you have all this variety. And to me, it's just thrilling to see all of this and what God has done. This is Mount Hood in the springtime. And some of the simplest things, you know, thistles. Kind of interesting picture there, because that was something that apparently was a result of the curse. And yet it still can be beautiful against the backdrop there of the setting sun. Psalm 111 verse 2 says, the works of the Lord are great, sought out of all them that have pleasure therein. I take great pleasure in seeing what the Creator created, but it would seem awful useless to have all this beauty in a world that simply got here by chance. Well, I believe dinosaurs fit into that marvelous creation. We can see just how creative the Creator was. I didn't take this photo, but I'd be real famous if I had. But you know, look at all the variety. Just a few here are the major types of dinosaurs that have been discovered. There are all different kinds that have been discovered. The first one was the 1822 discovery in England by a husband and wife, and they ended up naming this one because it had a tooth that looked like an iguana tooth, a large one. They called it Iguanodon, iguana tooth. The Brachiosaurus and Apatosaurus, the sauropods. Ankylosaurus, stiff lizard. The saurus ending, of course, means lizard. Stegosaurus with the bony back plates. And again, it may have been very colorful, as we see here in this artist's rendering of it. We don't know for sure what they look like as far as the skin. And, of course, T-Rex, king of the tyrant lizards. But you look at the variety here of all of these different creatures, and it's amazing. The Triceratops literally means three-horned face, one of the ceratopsids. And there were many different varieties of ceratopses, which just means horned faces. Most had one horn. Triceratops had three and was one of the largest. And, of course, besides those that, like Leviathan that were in the water, there were some in the air. There were flying reptiles such as Pteranodon and Quetzalcoatlus and the pterodactyls. There were many of these. Just amazing variety. Psalm 104:24, O Lord, how manifold are thy works! In wisdom thou hast made them all. The earth is full of thy riches. How manifold are his works! And you look at the variety. We're still discovering new species in areas that are very remote, plants and animals and all kinds of things we still haven't discovered. Well, people often ask, and then, if they really existed, if dinosaurs were real and have been around recently, what happened to the dinosaurs? Why did they apparently die out, or did they? Well, of course, we know that there was a worldwide judgment back in Genesis on sin. That would have killed nearly all the dinosaurs. Only the ones that were on the ark survived. And, of course, people ask about that, but all the ones that weren't on the ark were killed, many of them fossilized, along with people and plants, and a lot of organic matter was fossilized, and that's where we get our fossil fuels. But I believe that the ark, this big barge, and I love the ark model that's out there in the foyer, this huge barge-like structure was able to carry all of them because there weren't that many that needed to be on the ark. And so there were lots of animals on board, including dinosaurs. And in fact, they only needed about 100 dinosaurs. There were only probably about 50 dinosaur kinds. So 100 dinosaurs, you'd bring the younger, smaller ones on board, very easy to fit them on the ark. But then something drastic happened. The climate changed dramatically, it appears, after the flood. We know there was an ice age, and there's good evidence for it. In fact, right in this area, Puget Sound and a lot of the bays and areas were scoured by glaciers, and a lot of the peninsulas and islands are glacial deposits. And over in eastern Washington, you can see the scouring from the age of the glaciers. And I believe there was one ice age, and it followed the flood and lasted perhaps 1,000 years. Mike Ward has written much on this, and there's some books in the foyer. I encourage you to get resources from the Northwest Creation Network, by the way, while you're here, and learn more about all this. But that would have, of course, this worldwide climate change affected a lot of animals, not just dinosaurs. It would have affected their food supply, would have affected them directly. So what killed the dinosaurs? And I believe it was a number of factors. Of course, the flood itself killed all of them, except for the ones that Noah had on board the ark that he was commanded to bring. But then there was climate change, an ice age after the flood, which would have had a great impact, and apparently many weren't able to survive that, at least not for very long. But, of course, the flood is a possibility secular scientists won't consider, but there's also another possibility that they absolutely cannot consider. And that is, what may have finished off the dinosaurs was what finishes off a lot of species today, and that's overhunting by people. That's a distinct possibility, thinking biblically, in a biblical time frame, a biblical worldview. So if secular scientists won't consider some of these things, then what do they believe killed the dinosaurs? That's a good question. What do they think? Well, they have a lot of ideas. I think there have been 50 to 100 ideas proposed for how they became extinct in their mind 65 million years ago. Of course, the most commonly cited one now probably that's believed is a meteor struck the earth, either hit the land, and they probably didn't fly off the earth like that, but to illustrate it, it would have had a great impact, pardon the pun, but it would have affected the global climate. And they're looking at some kind of a global climate change, perhaps, because all the dust in the atmosphere would have cooled things down. Or someone proposed to hit the water and, you, again, have some global problems. In fact, they've even postulated huge tsunamis covering much of the earth. Essentially, kind of a flood scenario. But something catastrophic happening. Although they have a problem because they have many extinctions, mass extinctions, to deal with. So they can't answer any of them, but they have multiple ones. Well, we have a much simpler scenario. But, you know, back to what the Bible says. To me, what's most important isn't, I love the science, but what's most important is what does this teach us spiritually? When we look and we see dinosaur fossils in the record, What we're seeing is a record of death. And we know from what the Bible said that in Genesis 3, Adam and Eve sinned, rebelling against God, and sin brought forth death, teaches in the New Testament, 1 Corinthians and in Romans and elsewhere. It tells us that really, clear back in Genesis, you're seeing a picture of the gospel message. That sin brought forth death, and that's why we need a Redeemer. Because we are sinners. And when you find these fossils, whether it's dinosaurs or other fossils, a record of death there, that's God's judgment on sin that's recorded for us. And so it really points us back to the gospel and gives us a foundation clear back in Genesis. Well, I found this interesting. To look at the secular worldview, this was a children's book I had growing up, and I happened to find it a couple years ago, called In the Days of the Dinosaurs, published in 1959, which was a kind of a watershed year. That was the centennial of Darwin's publication of The Origin of Species. And there were some big Darwin celebrations, I guess, or promotions around the world. And this book may have been part of that. So I thought it was interesting what was said. This was geared toward early elementary age, and there wasn't much text in the book. Very simple reading. But there was quite a bit of text devoted to one theme. Page 11. It said, dinosaurs lived many, many millions of years ago. That was before there were any people. And by the way, the emphasis here was in the original. No human being ever saw a dinosaur. All of these great lizards disappeared millions of years before men, women, and children appeared on Earth. Then again on page 18. All the dinosaurs died millions of years ago. No man was alive to see them. And then on page 33. Comic books often show brontosaurus chasing people through the jungle. Of course, this never happened. The dinosaur lived 100 million years ago and no men were alive then. Repeatedly, time and time and time, it's saying the same thing. It usually started out or ended a chapter, trying to emphasize this point that they lived and died long before we were around. And of course, children read that. I read that at the time. That was part of my indoctrination when I was young. Well, this is what the world is saying then. Dinosaurs and people never lived together. But what does the Bible say? The Bible does say, of course, we've seen places where it appears to describe dinosaurs, and if they really existed, then if we look at the days of creation, on day 5, all the sea and flying creatures were created, so any of those flying reptiles or Leviathan would have been created then. Behemoth and the other land dinosaurs would have been day 6 with the other land animals and people. So people ask me, well, do you think that dinosaurs were around before people? And I say, yes, I think they were here hours before people. Even in some cases, depending on how you define dinosaur, if you include those in the water and the air, they may have been here more than a day before people. And they say, of course, what do you mean by day? That's another topic. Exodus chapter 20, verse 11. This was the clincher for me because I wrestled with this issue, and I wrestled with an old earth for a long time. But Exodus 20:11 was the clincher. I don't know, it takes different things for different people, and some people like me, I guess, are slow to figure this out. But it says here, with the Ten Commandments being given, why do we work 6 days and rest one day? It says, in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is. Everything was created in those 6 days, and he rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. That convinced me. That helped me also in trying to figure out how long the days were and the age of the earth. But it really helped me understand God made everything then. And then he ceased from his work of creation. He rested from that. That means back in the Garden of Eden then, Adam and Eve were living in harmony with dinosaurs. And of course we know the world will be restored back to those Edenic conditions in the future. Well, let me ask a couple of other questions. What evidence would it take to prove that humans and dinosaurs actually lived together? And I've thought of that. Well, what would it take to prove to someone that humans and dinosaurs lived together? And I'm talking proof. Now, science usually is incapable of proving something. We can often disprove something or falsify it, but to prove it, especially when we're looking at the historical sciences, is almost impossible. But we could prove it if we were to do something like this. If somebody rode in here on the back of a T-Rex, that's the kind of proof people want. They want something dramatic. And I've had Christians tell me, oh, I wish we could find a dinosaur, because that would be the nail in the coffin for evolution in an old Earth. And that would convince everyone. And you know, I thought about that and I thought, I wish that were true. I wish that were true and that we could find something like that and it would convince people to bow their knees before the Creator. And you know what the sad thing is? The Bible tells us that's not true. That wouldn't happen. We could come down one of the main streets in Seattle with a T-Rex, and you know what would happen? People who really are set in their beliefs wouldn't change. Would that evidence really convince a diehard evolution the creation account in the Bible is true? Would they just say, you're right, I'm a creationist? Unfortunately and sadly, no. In Luke chapter 16, verses 29 through 31, here at the end of the story, this is different than the parables where now you have real names being used, Lazarus being used, and Abraham, and the rich man. And Abraham is replying to this rich man who wanted Lazarus to go back and warn his brothers about this judgment to come. And Abraham said unto him, they have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them. And he said, nay, Father Abraham, but if one went unto them from the dead, they will repent. And he said unto him, if they hear not Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded, though one rose from the dead. Just as dramatic as marching a dinosaur down Main Street. So sadly, we know they wouldn't repent. In fact, we could find Noah's Ark and they'd deny a global flood. We could do all these things. And I'm not saying those are wrong to do, but that's not going to convince someone. In fact, the evidence never will by itself save anyone. We know that salvation is by faith through grace. Ephesians 2, 8, and 9. That's the only way it happens. It's not someone says, I just made an intellectual decision here and now I understand. That's great, and we have to get past that hurdle often, but it's more than that. Well, if humans and dinosaurs live together, here's another question. Why don't we find human and dinosaur fossils together in the fossil record? If we could, now there are some cases where there are footprints that may be genuine. In Texas, you've probably heard of the Paluxy River prints, and I know I haven't seen those personally, and so I don't talk about those. I don't know enough about those firsthand to know, and I know there are creationists who use that evidence and some who don't. There's some disagreement about that. But there are some possibilities where we found something like this. But even if we found really clear-cut evidence that even evolutionists would agree, yes, that is what we're seeing, is maybe a T-Rex with a person in its stomach. Okay, that's maybe the next best evidence to having a real T-Rex. Why don't we find these fossils together, though, in the fossil record clearly? Now, I would actually be amazed if we did. And the reason why is if you look at the relative abundance of fossils, if you go out and you randomly start digging for fossils somewhere to find something, most of the time, you won't have any trouble finding two types of fossils, things like clams, invertebrate marine fossils, which make up 95% of all the fossils, which makes sense in a flood scenario, or plants. In fact, recently at the John Day Fossil Beds, I found all kinds of fantastic leaf fossils, just perfectly preserved in the shale deposit. Now, those make up almost the other 5%. Most of it is plants. Insects make up almost all the rest. And then, you can't even see it on here, a line was too thick to show all the vertebrates. And the vertebrates there, you can't quite see it on the screen, it's mostly fish. 0.0125%, and most of that is fish. That means all the rest, mammals and birds and dinosaurs and humans, are very, very uncommon. Dinosaur fossils are very hard to find. If you find one, that's front page news. And if you find a human fossil, it is too. So to find them together by someone knowledgeable enough to know what they're seeing would be extremely rare. The probability is exceedingly small we would ever do that. But we have to also remember that, and this is a strange way of putting it maybe, but the absence of evidence isn't the same as evidence of absence. Evidence that we didn't live together. Now let me give you an example. We live with all kinds of animals today that we don't find in the fossil record with human fossils. But that obviously doesn't mean we didn't live with those because we know they're alive today. In fact, as far as I know, we've never found people in the same deposits as elephants or hippos or some of these other animals. But the point is, the absence of some type of evidence, unless you are omniscient and know everything and searched every square inch of the sedimentary rocks, you could never say that they don't exist. We may never find it, but it's there, but we've just not stumbled across it yet. But is there any evidence humans and dinosaurs actually lived together? And I believe there is mounting evidence. It's circumstantial, but that's about all you can do is build a case based on the preponderance of evidence. It's like a court of law. When we get into historical science, which is what we're doing with historical geology and paleontology, it's really building a case like you would in a court of law. One line of evidence would be petroglyphs, rock carvings. Pictographs are where they're actually drawn on or painted on the rock, but when it's engraved in the rock, it's a petroglyph. In Natural Bridges National Monument, there's one that looks like a dinosaur, specifically a brontosaurus. This was a recognized expert who has talked about this, and it does look like some kind of a sauropod dinosaur. It's a little faint there. You've probably, many of you, seen this. It's been well publicized. The neck, the long tail, like a cedar. And that may be some kind of a sauropod dinosaur. Now, actually, brontosaurus has been mentioned a couple of times, and that was a misnomer. In fact, apatosaurus is what we would now call that. They had put together different fossils, and they had the wrong head on the wrong body. And so brontosaurus, I loved brontosaurus, and brontosaurus is no more. But there are many others. And so it looks like one of those sauropods. More recently, and I heard one of the explorers who went over to Cambodia down at the conference down in Portland in February talk about this. They found on a temple in Cambodia built around 1050 AD, they found some interesting engravings. They had on a column there engraved some different animals. And there was one here that suspiciously looked like some kind of a dinosaur. It didn't quite fit what we know about dinosaurs, but they had other real animals there. They had deer and monkeys and birds. And then they had something that kind of looked like a stegosaur. The head wasn't right, but it could have been some kind of dinosaur we haven't found in the fossil record that they drew. But it had the bony plates on the back. And now I wouldn't use that by itself because some of these might be questionable or you could come up with another explanation. But when you find these time and time again around the world, it starts to make you wonder. In Peru, the Ica stones, these burial stones that have these drawings on there, again, this one looks like it has a bony plate on the back, but if you look at the head, it looks like it's very similar to a triceratops. It has three horns on the face, which is pretty distinctive. But it doesn't look like anything alive today. We would call it, even if it doesn't match a dinosaur we know of today, we'd call it a dinosaur based on what we see there. And there are others here, two dinosaurs attacking somebody, it looks like, and he's at least getting one of them. But it's interesting. This is from Peru. Then you look at Mexico. There are dinosaur figurines, all kinds of different figurines. That one, again, looks like some kind of a big sauropod, like an apatosaurus. Some of these people were a lot more artistic than me. People complain and say, it's not quite lifelike or doesn't look exactly real. If I had to make one of those out of clay, you wouldn't know what it is. So they did a lot better job than I did. But it makes you wonder. You see this time and time again, all these dragon legends, all these figurines and artifacts, something seems to be going on. Now, none of that proves conclusively. You can always make an argument against it. So if we look at this, well, what kind of evidence is there? We have rock art, petroglyphs, carvings. We have different artifacts, these Ica stones and the figurines. Dragon legends from around the world, detailed descriptions in many cases. And, of course, the best evidence that dinosaurs existed and were real and lived with people, lived recently, is from the Bible. Then the objection is, well, didn't dinosaurs die out over 65 million years ago? And, of course, people haven't been around nearly that long. Even evolutionists who stretch at the most wouldn't go back more than 2 or 3 million years for humans. Okay. So that's a huge gap. Well, some of you have heard of some of this evidence. Dr. Mary Schweitzer, North Carolina State University, has been the person who has really revolutionized this recently. And here in this quote, back in 1997 in Earth magazine, said, a thin slice of T-Rex bone glowed amber under the lens of my microscope. Blood vessel channels snaked through a bone matrix and tiny chambers known as lacuna, which house bone-forming cells, appeared as small ovals. Then a colleague took a look and shouted, you've got red blood cells. You've got red blood cells. Now, why would they be so excited about that? Because if you think about it, red blood cells, anything like this, that's not going to last 65 million or more years. And they never even thought to look for those in bones because they never, in their wildest imagination, expected to find such a thing. And, of course, they didn't want to break open their bones purposely to try to find out something that seemed ridiculous. But then they found this. Well, she was on national news, and this has been more recent, has found some other things. This is from the Science Daily website a year ago. Dr. Mary Schweitzer has succeeded in isolating soft tissue from the femur of a 68-million-year-old dinosaur, a T-Rex. Not only is the tissue largely intact, it's still transparent and pliable, and microscopic interior structures resembling blood vessels and even cells are still present. Now, kind of interesting, she's sort of an unorthodox person, came into this field later, and I guess she doesn't play by the rules and is finding things. She's actually a Christian, although listen to some statements she makes later, but she's a self-professed Christian. It goes on to say in that article, since current data indicate that living birds are more closely related to dinosaurs than any other group, according to evolutionists, Schweitzer compared the findings from the T-Rex with structures found in modern-day ostriches. In both samples, transparent branching blood vessels were present, and many of the small microstructures present in the T-Rex sample displayed the same appearance as the blood and bone cells in the ostrich sample. And by the way, this ostrich sample she used was only days old. It was a fairly fresh roadkill, or I don't know if it was roadkill or it had died on a farm, but anyway, she had a fresh ostrich, not too fresh because it was pretty smelly, decaying, decomposing. But look at these structures from an ostrich that had been dead for days compared to supposedly about a 68-million-year-old T-Rex femur. The top is these structures from the bone of the T-Rex, the bottom from the ostrich. And you look at that, and they do look similar. Of course, I believe you could find a lot of similarities with other animals as well, but they do look similar. It's very well preserved. Here's soft tissue. They found soft tissue. They found fibrous structures. This soft tissue, and you can see it's very small there, less than 0.1 millimeter in width, but it was still elastic. It could be stretched and would go back into shape. It was still pliable. Supposedly 65 million years old. So how can that be? Well, then another article said, young Earth creationists also see Schweitzer's work as revolutionary, but in an entirely different way. In fact, elsewhere it said that young Earth creationists have hijacked her research. All we did is look at what she reported, and it's fair enough for us to interpret it in a different way. Creation magazine, that's published by the Creation Ministries International now, it's called formerly AIG Australia, still available from them. Creation magazine, in an article by Carl Wieland, claimed Schweitzer's research was powerful testimony against the whole idea of dinosaurs living millions of years ago. It speaks volumes for the Bible's account of a recent creation. And I agree it does. This drives Schweitzer crazy. For her, science and religion represent two different ways of looking at the world. Invoking the hand of God to explain natural phenomena breaks the rules of science. After all, she says, what God asks is faith, not evidence. And I've heard that so many times, I'll just say it right here. Statements like that drive me crazy. And I mean that reverently as I can, but it really drives me crazy to have people separate this fact-faith dichotomy or religion versus science, however they want to do that, and have an upper story truth and lower story. That really does drive me crazy to see that, because it's basically taking religion, any faith, out of the public sphere and putting it in the private. It's okay to have your faith, but just keep it to yourselves. Well, what are the rules of science there that she refers to? Science is naturalism. It's been redefined. Science is naturalism. Only natural explanations are allowed. So they exclude the supernatural by definition, which is a great way to win an argument. If you exclude your opposition at the outset, then you can win every argument. So they can't even consider it, even if it's true, but I believe science, the word originally meant knowledge, should be a search for the truth. Whether we like what we find or not, we should be searching for the truth. But I think they've hijacked science now under the guise of naturalism. really it's philosophical naturalism that's disguised now as science. So to end here, let's look at this and use the same framework I mentioned earlier. We have a person with one presupposition, worldview, bias, or faith, a biblical theistic worldview, believing in a recent creation, looks at the elastic soft tissue in the dinosaur bones. That's the evidence, or the red blood cells. And we come up with a conclusion and say, well, of course, we expected this because those dinosaur bones are actually relatively young. Somebody else with a naturalistic old earth worldview would look at the same evidence. You can guess their interpretation. They look at it and say, wow, we didn't know that those structures could last so long. That's what they've said. There was no scientific reason to expect them to last that long. Okay? But they have basically just interpreted it in a way that's consistent with their beliefs. My friend Dr. Chittick said in his book, The Puzzle of Ancient Man, either one uses the scriptures as the absolute standard of all truth or uses some other presuppositional system generated by man's mind as the absolute standard. The remark science says is a tip-off that man's opinion is the test of truth. When someone says scripture says, it's probable that person's using the Creator's word as the standard for truth. And I hear people say that, and they say, they're Christians, but they say, but science says, and immediately, I know they're not thinking biblically. They're trying to elevate science, whether they realize it or not, they're elevating science above scripture to reinterpret it. But the central verse in the Bible is Psalm 118, verse 8. It says, it is better to trust in the Lord than to put confidence in man. One more example of this, how they view this. Another evolutionist said, one of the things we have here is a part of the hip bone or pelvis. Now, this specimen looks like it had come from an animal that looks like it died 200 or 300 years ago. All dry, chalky, that sort of thing, doesn't actually mean it died 200 or 300 years ago. In Montana, I've seen dinosaur bones that look like they've come from animals that died 200 or 300 years ago. And I know very well that they died much longer ago than that. It looks, for all the world, like one thing. It looks like that gorge was formed catastrophically, but we know better. It looks like these are young, but we know better. So it gives us a lesson. Sometimes this is true of all of science, but this is very, very common in science. If the facts contradict your beliefs, your reigning model or paradigm, throw out the facts. Don't throw out the model. Add more secondary assumptions. But facts are not value-free. No such thing as a value-free fact. They have to be interpreted according to your belief system. Well, last quote here regarding Schweitzer. Her interest in the long-term preservation of molecules and cells does have an otherworldly dimension. She's now collaborating with NASA scientists on the search for evidence of possible past life on Mars, Saturn's moon Titan, and other heavenly bodies. Gets into a whole other topic about whether or not there are aliens, but most evolutionists believe, yes, if life evolved here, it must have evolved elsewhere. Maybe it evolved elsewhere and got transplanted here, but they're desperately seeking intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. And I teach college students, and I wish there were intelligent life here. I'd be happy with that. Anyway, I have some very good students, too, I should say that. But there's no mystery about dinosaurs. If we look at this biblically and think biblically and base our thinking there, it helps shape our scientific understanding. Psalm 95:6 says, come let us worship and bow down, and let us kneel before the Lord our Maker. It's too bad that not everyone will do that, and they'll be forced to eventually. Psalm 96, for the Lord is great and greatly to be praised. He is to be feared above all gods, for all the gods of the nations are idols, but the Lord made the heavens. All right, thank you. Chris?